Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.
In a couple of weeks, I have an appointment with the Disney Studios to bring to them a brand new invention of mine, which is patented. It's a totally new kind of animation that has never been done before, otherwise I wouldn't have gotten a patent on it. It looks very much, if I was going to give a description of what it looks like a piece of animation done by Norman Rockwell. That's
more realistic.
Absolutely, totally, totally realistic. As a matter of fact, the reason that it is realistic is because it is not an animation at all.
Is that where you,
it's a process.
You filmed the actual thing happening when you...
I filmed the actual actor. Yes, and then I put it through a process. I've got what's called the process patent.
It's almost like those Levi commercials.
That's the process. That's mine.
Oh, really?
That's the process. I put them on notice already a couple of times through my attorney, but my attorney says that at this particular time it doesn't pay to sue because there hasn't been enough exposure and there wouldn't be enough damages and there wouldn't really be enough to go into court at this time. He says, let them do a lot more. Let them collect a lot more. We put them on notice every time. They're doing my process. But I have got the patent on it, see? Now, what I started off saying was, the thing that bothers me, and I'm going to be bringing this to Disney Studios, they, above all people, should know that processes evolve, that what they will be looking at is tantamount to the early Disney stuff that Walt used to do. And then he'd get into the sweatbox with these animators. And he would criticize and he would evaluate and they would change this and change that. And this is how slowly the Disney technique evolved. What bothers me is that when I bring an invention like this over, even to a Disney studio, they, of all people, should realize that I, too, did mine in a garage somewhere by myself without the help of professional people in the animating business, and that what they're looking at is really the rudimentary form which they, in their expertise, would be able to take and develop and go from there. But even the Disney people who have gone through this phase sit down and look at it as if I had $1 million to develop it, all the high-powered talent in Hollywood, and I did it in a big Hollywood studio, and I had all the lab work at my facilities, like CFI or some other big lab downtown. It really, really bothers me that they can't sit back and say, we're taking a look at this. If we like it, we will put our knowledge to it, our technique to it, and add to it and let it grow. See, I don't say I'm walking in with this process to replace what they have. You can't replace what Disney's got. But what I say is you can blend the two together beautifully. You can merge the two on one screen together.
Yes, without
beautifully. Well, it wouldn't look like putting animation on top of live, which never quite comes, really comes off.
They did some pretty realistic things like the Sleeping Beauty.
But I mean, like for example, with Mary Poppins or Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and things like, you know, it's animation against live, which is cute, but never really comes off. You know, the actor is not really looking at this animated figure.
Yes.
The eyes are, you know, and,
well,
the stuff that I got could blend so beautifully because it's not two different techniques coming together. It looks like one basic technique, but one is Disney-esque with all of its qualities and all of its stylization up against a Norman Rockwell type of animation, which is ideal for bringing in recognizable people.
Sure.
You know, take John Wayne and bring him in. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So we'll see what happens.
Without giving the whole process away, how would you kind of describe what it is in just a nutshell?
Well, I photograph the actor up against a white background devoid of any information whatsoever. Then I process that film through a series of high contrast printing until I have nothing left but a line drawing. And then I super that against an animated background.
So you have that outline to go from.
And, it's done the same way animation is done. Mm-hmm. My cells are
okay,
painted and all the rest. You know, they're painted, so they look...
Sounds like a lot of fun to work with.
Oh, I've got a minute and 15 second demonstration film, which is what I'm going to show them.
Hmm. What is it of?
Lucille Ball.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
In your show, or...?
No, something I directed her in special for this. It couldn't be in the show because it had to be done with different backgrounds and all special technique. I directed her over at Universal Studios on one of the sound stages there. At least that part of the development I had, you know, real top draw going for me. Because...
Would you like half of this?
No, thank you very much.
Yeah. Tell me about the bathtub with the
cloud. Oh, the two stories.
Yes.
I had never done any television in my life. I had done about 6 years of radio. And in radio, you work on a microphone. And even though you're a ventriloquist, you don't put the dummy near the microphone. You keep the dummy out here, and you stay on mic. So as you're doing both voices, it's recording fine. Now, television began coming into the picture, and it was around 1947 when Ed Sullivan called me, because I had done a lot of benefit performances with Ed at hospitals around New York, and he wanted me to come on his television show. Oh, I was very excited about it. I've never done any television before, so I came down, and we went through the dress rehearsal. This is the first moment of my life that I was ever in front of the camera. And I stepped out on the stage and put my foot up on the chair with Jerry on my lap and began to go into my routine. Mm-hmm. Suddenly there was a knocking on the control room window on the glass. I looked over and I could see Ed pantomiming to me that he couldn't hear the dummy very well. He was telling me that my voice was fine, but the dummy's voice was very, very soft. He could hardly hear it. I couldn't understand what could be the reason for that. So I said, all right, I'll start again. Now, what I tried to do was to pace myself and begin making Jerry's voice much louder than I had just done. Again, there was a knock on the glass. Pantomiming to his ear, he couldn't hear the dummy's voice very well. It was still very soft. I started to get a little anxious. I told him I would try once more. The third time, what I tried to do, I lowered my voice, bringing it much, much softer, and brought Jerry's up so his was at least equal to mine in volume, or maybe even a bit louder, and I started again. And to my dismay and shock and horror, Ed knocked on the glass again and said, no use. Did something wrong. I don't know what the hell it is, but maybe ventriloquism doesn't work for TV. Maybe there's something strange about the art that doesn't record proper. And I was absolutely destroyed because I thought that my career was in TV was ending before it was even beginning. Now, I don't know what prompted me to look up at that moment. I don't know what in the world prompted me to look up. But as I was doing my routine for the last time, I looked up and I saw the boom man racking the microphone over my head when I was talking and then racking the microphone over Jerry's head when he was talking and then racking back and forth over my head when I was talking.
He just got caught up in the whole thing.
Well, I realized that up until that point, a ventriloquist had not yet appeared in TV, and this man was so completely conditioned that when there were two people, he just he racked back and forth, and you know, that's he was conditioned to that. When suddenly I got the whole thing, I said, Ed, excuse me 1 minute, please. I walked over very quietly to the boom man. I explained to him that the dummy was not talking and that he must keep the microphone over my head no matter what it looks like and don't move it at all. He suddenly got it and he realized what he had done. I went back and I said, okay, Ed, I think we got it straightened up. And I proceeded. And he knocked on the glass and he gave me the sign that everything was sounding fine.
That's funny.
Funny, but it was like a feeling that my whole world was ending before it even started on TV, you know, because there were in the past strange phenomenon when silent movies began to add sound. And there were several very big motion picture stars whose voices didn't record with the kind of timbre that the audience
had expected.
Yeah. And careers were destroyed. John Gilbert was one. John Gilbert was an extremely important motion picture star in silent movies. He worked with Garbo, he worked with Norma Shearer, he worked with the biggest in those days. And when sound came in, he had kind of a tenor, high-pitched voice, which to the average theater goer didn't have the manly quality that they had anticipated. All right, I'll tell you the second one. Second story happened when I was much, much younger.
The bathtub story.
Yes. I was much younger at that particular time. I was still working on the road with Major Bowes after winning his radio show. And I was still making my own dummies. I think I told you about that. I went to a school puppetry class, how I made dummies.
Made one out of paper mache that you
Well, the way we made dummies in those days is you would take a soft clay called plasticine. You'd model your figure, your head, and then you would put it into a box, and then you would pour plaster halfway, and then you would grease the rim of the plaster before you pour the second half so it wouldn't stick. Then you'd fill up the box with plaster. And when it was done and hard, and you took it apart where you had greased it, it would come apart and you'd have two halves, like two halves of a cantaloupe.
Your mold.
Your mold. And then you would use your paper mache or your plastic wood or whatever material you wanted to inside this female mold. Well, when I was in Cleveland and I was working at the theater, and I was on the road, so I didn't have many things to work with, I decided to make another dummy. Because in those days, I could make the head and cast it in a week. And then I figured I would take the cast with me to the next town, work on the paper mache, and make another dummy. I got the clay, and I fashioned the head. Now, usually, you make a box, and the box is usually wood, so that your plaster mold will be of a prescribed size. You don't want it to get too big. It'll be within that, and when you're finished, you take the box apart, and you have the two halves, see? Well, on the road, I didn't have the facilities to construct the box, and to get the wood and to build. So I figured I would just go out and get a cardboard box of an adequate size. Well, I got the box, I got all the plaster. I was living in a hotel at the time. See, on the road we lived in hotels. I decided that I would do the pouring so that I wouldn't mess up the place in the bathtub of the hotel. And I had a pan that I bought, and I placed the head inside the box and began to mix up my plaster. This was one evening after the show was over, and I decided I would work several hours, if necessary, into the night and get this done. Shouldn't take too long because plaster dries relatively fast. Well, I mixed up the batch of plaster. I poured the first half. The cardboard box began to get wet and began to get soggy. But it managed to hold for the bottom half of the mold. But as I began to pour the top half, the box fell apart. The plaster no longer had any confines to keep itself. It began to run all over the bathtub. I try to scoop it back up and put it back up. and I couldn't get it going. I didn't want to lose the dummy. I poured more plaster. I tried to put it on anyway. When I finally finished, I had the bathtub. The dummy, you couldn't get at the head. It was covered with plaster. It was in that tub. Uh-huh. And the plaster was like halfway filling up that tub practically.
Down the drain.
Oh, down the drain, everything. Well, I didn't think to plug the drain up, you know? But I got so panicked when things began to run.
Yeah.
Well, I was very worried. And the next day, between shows at the theater, when I went back to the hotel to check, see what I could do, when I asked for my key, there was a note in my box to come and see the manager. I went into the manager's office. The guy says, "What the hell are you doing up in that? You know what you have caused up there in the plumbing and the blah, 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 and the whole thing." And I, well, they threw me out of the hotel, and they gave me a bill that I had to take an advance on my salary from Major Bowes, because I was on the road anyway for week after week. I was working with him for, you know, almost a year to pay this thing and get out of there, and left the head under the plaster,
still there
in that bathtub. They probably had to replace the whole damn bathtub and fix some of the plumbing as well.
That's terrible. That's funny.
So those were the two anecdotes I wanted to tell you about.
You were about 16, 17?
No, it wasn't even that. I was just about 15.
Really?
Yeah.
Tell me about your voiceovers for cartoons. What was the first one that you did? How'd you get into that? We didn't even talk about that last time.
Oh, I don't know. I've been doing commercials, and I've got commercials. Have you seen one that just started playing lately? It looks like a cookie monster, and it eats grapes all the time.
Yes, it sounds like you.
Yeah, that's one of mine.
What is that for?
And just grapes. The grape council.
Grape, yes.
The grape. A little boy is talking to him.
Thing, yes.
Yeah, that purple. He keeps, you know, "Oh, well, hey, what is this here?" That kind of.
And I've seen them. The commercials you just did with Jerry.
Oh yeah, the wheat for Kellogg's.
Yes.
Yeah, the mini wheats. Mm-hmm. Yeah, then there's one Knucklehead does with Smokey the Bear. I don't know if you've seen that. That's a public service thing. And then I got this scrubbing bubbles.
Yes, you talked about that.
One that goes down the drain.
Snap, crackle, and pop.
Snap, crackle, and pop. And,
weren't you on a Starkist commercial? Was it a squid or something?
Yeah, yeah. Squid. One of the squids. And then I've got, I've just tested for Coco Krispies, a lead character of an elephant.
Mm-hmm.
So if Kellogg's accepts that, I'll have a few, you know, few commercials with that.
Of course, that's all done in Hanna-Barbera down there.
Oh, no, we don't do that.
No.
These client spots like this, they take out different recording studios around town. Hanna-Barbera, I have done...
I have a list. Some of the things. The banana splits hour.
Yeah, Flegel.
And what is that character?
Flegel?
Yeah. It's an elf.
Flegel is a dog.
A dog?
A dog, yeah. Then there's one I'm on now called the Woofer and Whimper.
I have that one done. that?
Yeah, I do. Well, it's on Clue Club. On the Clue Club. It's two dogs. I play the part of Woofer. Mm-hmm. He's a big, floppy kind of, little kind of dog, you know. Then there was Dick Dastardly.
Yes, Dastardly and Mutterly in their flying machine.
Yeah, and then there was the...
Dick Dastardly.
Dick Dastardly.
I brought something along. I was wondering if that was...
And then the wacky races we had.
Tell me.
And then we had the motorcycles.
This looks like it.
Wheelie and the Chopper. But yeah, Dick Dastardly. One of those villains.
We'll get him, Mustardy, if it's the last thing we ever do.
Crazy kind of a... very much like Jack Lemmon in the Great Race.
Oh, yes.
One of those wild kind of...
And you were also the general, weren't you?
Oh, I don't know. The Screen Actors Guild allows you to do three characters on each show. And there was another, a Wheelie and the Chopper Bunch. Well, Wheelie and it was the cast was just motorcycles instead of people. It was a group of motorcycles, and I played a character named Revs.
Thought I had brought out. Is that one of them?
No.
No.
No. It's just motorcycles. Just motorcycles. And then they'd bring me in for
and Goober and the Ghost Chasers.
Goober, yeah, I did Goober.
And how would you describe Goober?
Goober was a silly dog. I've done a lot of dogs for them over there. Mm-hmm. Very much like a Bert Lahr. That's ridiculous. What are you guys saying? I'm one of those kind of guys, yeah. A silly kid who talks this way. That kind of Woofer and Whimper, also dogs. Flegel was a dog. A lot of alternate characters that are not steady characters running through series where they bring me in to do just different characters on, like Pebbles and Bam Bam and
Hong Kong
Phooey or Flintstones or
These Are the Days, the Grape Ape.
The Grape Ape, but those were just not steady characters on the Grape Ape. The Wacky Races played the Ant Hill Mob. Kind of a Bogart.
As the Perils of Penelope Pitstop.
Well, no, no, almost. That was a spinoff from it.
I see.
The Wacky Races, the Ant Hill Mob. Well, they were in the Penelope, mm-hmm. But they originally came from the the Wacky Races. Yeah, I did sort of a Bogart kind of a, you know, or a, all right, you guys, one of those.
You did Clyde and Softy.
Yeah.
And John Messick did the rest of them, right?
Yeah, yeah. So the only ones you don't have, apparently, are the Wheelie and the Chopper Bunch, mm-hmm. Which was the cast of motorcycle rather than people.
About
and I've done some stuff over at D. Patty Freeling.
Mm-hmm.
I did a thing called the Oddball Couple.
Okay.
Have you heard of that one?
No.
Well, it's the Oddball Couple, and I did the dog too. I did the big. There was a big sloppy dog, and there was a cat. You know Frank Nelson. Frank Nelson, guy who goes, well, used to be on Jack Benny's show. Well, he played the cat, and I played the dog, and we were the oddball couple. And then they brought me in for Mr. Jabba Jaws. And I did several series over there for them, too.
Jabba Jaws, was that the shark?
Yeah, the shark.
And you did incidental voices on that?
Yes. No, I did one of the leads on that. Some underwater character. It was always underwater, a diver, a scuba diver or something.
Tell me about the Disney things you've done with Tigger. Now, was that the first time you worked with Disney?
No, I did the Aristocats.
Oh, that's right, that's right.
I did the Aristocats for Disney. I did two parts in that.
I think Lucille Bliss mentioned she was in that also, wasn't she?
It's hard to tell over there because you don't work together.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yes.
Gee, I don't know. I've done the Dr. Seuss specials.
Oh, you have?
The Green Eggs and Ham. Did you ever see that one? Green Eggs and Ham.
Yeah, I know the book, but it's...
And the Sneetches.
That was... Did Freeling do that?
Yes. And the Sneetches.
And Marvin Miller narrated that, didn't he?
I believe so.
Two voices in it.
I believe so.
Rich Little.
And then I did a Bing Crosby special with Avery Schreiber.
How did you get the call for Tigger? Did you try out for it? Or?
Yes, oh yeah, you try out for all this stuff. Oh yes. Even the Kellogg stuff that I'm doing.
I thought there were occasions where they say, well, get a Paul Winchell type.
No way, you try out for everything. This thing I've got now over there, it's called Boomer. It's a woodpecker in this new one called The Fox and the Hound. That won't be out till 1981.
Oh, really?
But I had to try out for that. I had to go over and ask them what kind of character they had in mind and what they were looking for. And
they had put out some records that had Tigger on it.
Oh, yeah.
Previous. Did you come up with your own kind of sound, or did they say they wanted...
Oh, those records weren't put out previous to the motion picture.
They weren't?
No.
I thought that there were some that had...
No, you see, the first recording I wouldn't sign, so they had to get somebody else to do Tigger.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I wouldn't sign for recordings.
Why was that?
Well, because... It was just my principle, you know. If you're working in a medium like that and it's making millions of dollars, why should you settle for absolute peanuts, you know? So that was just a...
That's why you turned it down.
Well, it was a negotiation point, and I just turned it down. The second one, I let him have. So that's why I appear on the second Tigger. Winnie the Pooh and Tigger 2, I appear on that one, on the phonograph. As a matter of fact, I won the Grammy.
For the record.
I won the Grammy for the record.
I brought the record.
By letting him use the record, we won the Grammy.
It was all chewed up, so I trimmed it. I got it at a good room. Where I get all my things. I got it a long time ago.
Very good.
It's nice you got, you know, so much credit, because some of the older albums, you'd never see that. You know, Cinderella and Pinocchio, you would never see any names anywhere.
Right.
And this is nice to finally see credit.
Yeah.
Given.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about that? Do you have any stories at all about how long did it take to do the whole thing down there? Was it the biggest, longest running?
Well, we did two of them. One was Winnie the Pooh and the Blustery Day. That was when Tigger made his first appearance. And he made such a hit. that they came out with this one, which featured the Tigger character. And that was called Winnie the Pooh and Tigger 2.
Had you been a fan all along of
Milne?
Yeah.
No, not especially.
You knew the character somewhat.
Well, I knew Winnie the Pooh. Didn't know about the Tigger, you know, or how to play him. As a matter of fact, it is my candid opinion that Disney has just wasted this character. Because you can go on with it. I mean, Tigger could be used in the Disney television show. Mm-hmm. Tigger can be used as a character. He was a strong, powerful figure.
Yes.
He could have his own series of bits where he could come out with a high hat or something, or you know. I mean, they've just let it go. Completely let it go. It's my thinking that they've just wasted a potential property.
Yeah, that's a shame, because that's why I asked you about the Disney special that just came on. I was rather disappointed with, I like to see the cartoons that they did, but all of the tie-ins, the people that they had to host the show, was all rather disappointing, you know?
Oh yeah, it was just nothing.
I mean, how would Disney feel about it if he was alive to see it?
It wouldn't have been that way.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have been that way. There was nobody like Walt, boy.
Yeah.
There was nobody like Walt. Nobody. Nobody. Walt was the kind of a guy that if you had spent a lot of money on something and he looked at it and he didn't like it, he would throw it out.
Mm-hmm.
Not these guys. Because that dictates a lot of...
Whatever will sell.
Well, not only that, but if you've invested that money on it, it's ridiculous to throw it out. It's cost you that much.
Mm-hmm.
Let's recoup. But that's not the way he was, boy. If something wasn't playing right or didn't have the right charm or wasn't animated right or something, out. It went out. But they'd say, Walt, look what it cost us. We'll make it up, he says. Don't worry about it. There was nobody like him. Tremendous, tremendous
did
guy.
Did you meet with him? Did you?
Yes, yeah.
Be
oh, I knew him. Yeah. Yeah, I knew him.
Tell me a good Walt Disney story. Because I have a lot of them now, and I'm putting together a Walt Disney tape. I have Ward Kimball and June Foray.
Well, you need guys like Card Walker.
Oh, yes, I'm missing a lot, but I'm beginning, you know.
Yeah.
Start somewhere.
You need guys like...
I have Sidney Miller. I have some of the Mouseketeers I've contacted.
Well...
Clarence Nash I'd like to meet.
Yeah, Ducky Nash. Ducky Nash. I knew him too.
Well, he's supposed to live right locally here in the valley somewhere. You got a good Walt Disney story you could pull out of the hat?
No, not really. Just to know him was enough,
You
know? Just to know him, and if you came to the studio, well, you could get to his office. And he'd walk you around the grounds. And it's lunchtime, he'd take you into the commissary, you'd have something to eat with him. I mean, he was just a human, down-to-earth, real, solid guy, unimpressed by what he had done, only concerned about growth and what else he could do and how he could grow into other things. The whole damn Disneyland and Disney World is because Walt Disney thought that the goddamn amusement parks of our country are cheesy and cruddy. And
yes.
That's why it got a class operation, you know? All him, all his brain, all his... And the way he had that that train around his home?
I didn't know he had a train.
Oh, God, he had a train with tracks. He had tracks laid off.
He had a home in Beverly Hills. Is that the home?
He had, no, I think it was the one before they moved to Beverly. I don't know which one, but he had, and his wife, Lily, she was against this train business.
So at, like a miniature
at the
train?
Beginning, at the beginning, you know, till she saw what kind of relaxation it provided and how it got him away from his work and how he was, and he put on his what's the engineer, you know, the guy, and blow that horn, and drive around his property on that train. Some guy, boy.
He had a Moulin Roadster.
Yeah. He was a pretty big polo player, too, you know. Played a lot of polo when he was younger, but he had terrible polo injury all through his neck area. He used to sit at the studio all the time, and his girl Friday would put hot packs on his... Walt had a lot of pain. Most people don't know that. He had a lot of physical pain.
Had he been around today, maybe you could help him with your acupuncture.
Maybe.
Pressure.
Maybe. It's a shame, boy, when you lose a guy like that. It's a shame. Christ.
I hear rumors that he's frozen somehow.
Oh, no.
That's not true.
No. I don't know
people
where rumors.
Like to believe.
I don't know where rumors come from.
You've heard that, haven't you?
Oh yes, I've heard that. But I've also heard that there was a very small private funeral, and it was cremated. That's what I've heard. So you hear these other, what is it, cryogenics?
I don't know the word.
Yeah, cryogenics, freezing.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah, well, cryo is freezing, and genics is the genesis of the...
You don't believe in it. maybe one of these days?
Maybe one of these days, but we sure aren't ready for it yet.
Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.